And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpit, here's Nick Perez.
That's right. Welcome to the new era of eloquence and exposition, Live from the Pulpit, the fastest half-hour podcast in the West. Live and local, on location at Merced Church of Christ, deep in the heart of the Central Valley, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society. With a little help from my friends, I am your host for this half-hour excursion into theology and other sundry matters, the voice of the valley, Nick Perez. Greetings. Welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. Well, there's been all kinds of uproar in recent days over some of the remarks that our fearless leader, President Obama, made during the National Prayer Breakfast. This was this past Thursday. And I quote, "Lest we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place, remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ." Now, there's more to his comments than that, but that gives you a little taste of what we're talking about here with Pastor Obama explaining to us how we should view the world, how we should keep in context the atrocities being committed by ISIS militants. ISIS, by the way, the first IS stands for Islamic State. These are Muslim fighters fighting under the banner of Islam. And they're all about control, submission. You submit to us, we will control you. Convert, or we'll cut your head off. That's the Islamic way, at least the proper expression of it. Allah, Muhammad, the prophet, and his ilk that followed after him. It's interesting how some historians have responded to this. They are quick to discourage a link between ISIS and the Crusaders. "I don't think the president knows very much about the Crusades," Thomas Madden, a historian at the University of St. Louis, told ABC News. "He seems to be casting them as an example of a distortion of Christianity and trying to compare that to what he sees as a distortion of Islam in the actions of ISIS," Madden said. "The initial goal of the Crusades was to give back lands to Christians that had been conquered due to Muslim conquests." Aha! Now we're starting to get a flavor of why in the world the Crusades took place. And in fact, I'm going to go to Justo Gonzalez. He's written a book, a couple of volumes, as a matter of fact, called The Story of Christianity. In volume one of that work, during the section on medieval Christianity, he talks about the Arab conquests, which began in the 7th century. And I quote, "Then something unexpected happened. Out of Arabia, a forgotten corner of the world that had been generally ignored by both the Roman and the Persian empires, a tidal wave of conquest arose that threatened to engulf the world. In a few years, the Persian Empire had vanished, and many of the ancient Roman territories were in Arab hands. The driving force behind this human avalanche was Muhammad, an Arab merchant who had always had deep religious interests and who had come in contact with both Judaism and the various Christian sects that existed in Arabia, some of them rather unorthodox. His message, which he claimed had been revealed to him by Gabriel, was that of a single God, both just and merciful, who rules all things and requires obedience from all. It was often presented in rhythmic fashion, like that of the ancient Hebrew prophets. Muhammad claimed that he was not preaching a new religion, but simply the culmination of what God had revealed in the Hebrew prophets and in Jesus, who was a great prophet, although not divine, as Christians claimed." So let me pause right there and bring you up to speed. Muhammad, being exposed to rather unorthodox branches of Judaism and Christianity, plagiarized. He plagiarized from Christianity and Judaism and invented a hybrid religion based on these unorthodox views. Many of the views that you find in the Quran are very unorthodox. Things he'd been exposed to as a merchant. And in fact, this comes from a different tome on church history by Bruce Shelley. He gives a little bit of the background on Muhammad. He talks about how at the age of 25, he was commissioned from being a keeper of camels to take care of the business affairs of a wealthy widow 15 years his senior. And so as he's doing business, not only with the shepherds out there in Arabia, but also in his business dealings for this widow, he was exposed to a lot of this stuff. This is documented in Washington Irving's book on Muhammad. And having been exposed to these unorthodox views, he amalgamated them. And from this admixture came the twisted doctrines that you find in the Quran and the Islamic religion. And one of the tenets of Islam is that Jesus is not deity. He's not divine. He's not God. I continue here with Gonzalez's comments. Since polytheism was closely related to their business, the merchants in Mecca opposed the preaching of Muhammad, who took refuge at the nearby oasis where Medina would eventually become a great city. They didn't want what he was peddling. And at first, I've mentioned this before on the program, Islam, yeah, there was a lot of peace about it. Why? Well, Muhammad had stolen that from Judaism, Shalom, Christianity, and the preaching of Christ. A lot of peace in all that. He stole it. But when the warlike people didn't want it and they fought against him because they liked their polytheism and they were warlike to begin with, that's when the message of Muhammad very quickly shifted. The date of that flight, writes Gonzalez, AD 622, is the beginning of the Muslim era, from which years are counted. So that was year zero, I guess. AD 622, the beginning of the Muslim era, or the Muslim error. Maybe that was a Freudian slip. There he founded the first Muslim community in which worship, as well as civil and political life, followed the guidelines set out by him. Then he and his followers set out on a military and political campaign that eventually gave them control over Mecca. Again, that's the evolution of Muhammad's thinking. When he realized that the warlike people would not accept his message of peace, when he realized that it was much more easy to conquer by the sword rather than with the word, that's when he took up sword and began this military political campaign to take over control of Mecca. At that point, Muhammad decreed that his former enemies were forgiven, although all idols must be overthrown. And if they didn't give up their polytheism, well, he put them to the sword. I'm improvising here, ad-libbing to what Gonzalez leaves out, but that's what's going on here in history. By his death in 632, a goodly part of Arabia was in Muslim hands. Then leadership passed on to the caliphs. You've probably heard of the caliphate. That's what they're trying to establish with Sharia law and all that stuff. Comes from the Arabic word meaning successor. And there was a fight at the beginning concerning who would take over, who would be the caliph, who would be the successor to Muhammad. And it was divided for a little bit until eventually Abu Bakr, he took power, consolidated it, and the Muslims achieved their first victory over the Byzantine armies. Under Omar, the Arabs invaded Syria. In 635, they took Damascus and Jerusalem. In 638. 2 years later, they were masters of the entire region. At the same time, another Muslim army invaded Egypt, founded what would later become Cairo, and took Alexandria in 642. By 647, they were again marching westward along the northern coast of Africa. Meanwhile, a third army invaded the Persian Empire, whose last king died in 651. After that date, with minor setbacks, the Muslims swept through what had been one of the most powerful kingdoms on earth. During the second half of the century, Muslim advantage was somewhat slowed by inner strife, but it continued nonetheless. Carthage fell in 695, and soon many of the inhabitants of North Africa, who had lived through so much strife between Catholics, Donatists, Arians, and Byzantines, accepted Islam. By 711, a small band crossed the Straits of Gibraltar, whose name is derived from their leader Tariq, and found the Visigothic kingdom so weakened that they overran it. Soon all of Spain, except for the extreme northern areas, was under Muslim rule. From there, they crossed the Pyrenees and threatened the very heart of Western Europe. In 732, they were finally defeated by Charles Martel at the Battle of Tours, which marked the end of the first wave of Muslim expansion. In about a century, that's what Gonzalez maps out here, the timeline. In about a century, the Muslim expansion had conquered a great deal of what had once been the Roman Empire. That has a significant impact on Christianity, because after all, they've taken over Jerusalem. They've also taken over Antioch, Damascus, Alexandria, Carthage. These are all ancient centers of Christianity. Well, now they're all under Muslim control. And in fact, in some of these areas, like Carthage, Christianity had completely disappeared. Now, from what I understand, for centuries, the Muslim occupiers of those territories, they allowed for peaceful Christians to make pilgrimages to, say, Jerusalem. For centuries that happened. And those acts of devotion, one of the highest acts was to take a pilgrimage, that was the idea. That happened for centuries. That changed under the Seljuk Turks, who had become Muslims and they were threatening the Byzantine Empire. And so what happens is, after centuries of relatively peaceful coexistence, even though the Muslims had taken by force what was originally in Christian hands, when the Seljuk Turks took power, well, there was some grief, there was some strife, there were reports that some of the Christians were being persecuted as they were making their pilgrimage to Jerusalem, mistreated in some sense. Some try to discount this as rumor, but it would seem that there is some validity to these reports. And so what happens is, under Urban II, Pope Urban II, the time was now ripe. And in 1059, he proclaims the great enterprise. I quote from Urban II. He says, "I say it to those who are present. I command that it be said to those who are absent. Christ commands it. All who go thither and lose their lives, be it on the road or on the sea or in the fight against the pagans, will be granted immediate forgiveness for their sins. This I grant to all who will march by virtue of the great gift which God has given me." Forgiveness of sins. Something which had not been fully expressed until Urban II. This kind of absolution was not known until the impassioned appeal of Pope Urban II. Yes, this is a very Catholic enterprise. If it's any kind of Christian, it's Catholic, because it's ignited by Pope Urban II. Well, once Urban delivers this very passionate appeal to the multitude, a roar begins among the people. They begin to chant, Deus vult, Deus vult, God wills it. And that will become the battle cry of the Crusaders against the Muslim enemy. The Crusaders, they were human beings. Their motives were mixed, sometimes even often in conflict. The word crusade itself comes from taking the cross after the example of Christ. And so that's why whenever the Crusaders ventured out from the Holy Land or for the Holy Land, they wore the cross on their breast, and then on their journey home, they wore it on their back. They had been promised spiritual rewards, including the full forgiveness of past sins by Pope Urban. But there were probably also some desire for material wealth, material riches, not just the spiritual reward, but material riches. There was also, I'm sure, some desire to reclaim the territory where the sacred feet of Christ had once tread. And so there were actually a number of routes taken by several different groups. Peter the Hermit, he set out for Jerusalem with a disorganized mob, and they had a tough go of it. They finally arrive by the formal group led by the Bishop of Puy, Adhemar, and he was named as Urban's personal representative. They get all these guys together. They converge at Constantinople. They're received by the Emperor Alexis. And with the help of the Byzantines, they take Nicaea, which had been the capital of the Turks. And then they marched on to Antioch, and they endured a lot of sufferings when they crossed Asia Minor. At the walls of Tarsus, a couple of the guys, they quarreled, and Baldwin, who was Godfrey's younger brother, Godfrey, the one who's one of the leaders of this group, well, Baldwin, he decides to abandon the enterprise entirely. He goes back to the Arminians to establish himself as their leader. But the siege of Antioch was a difficult enterprise. The Crusaders ran out of food. But then they had a stroke of divine intervention, shall we say, when an Arminian Christian within the city opened the gate for them, and under the cry of Deus vult, God wills it, the Crusaders entered the city, and the Turkish defenders holed up in a citadel. For 4 days, they besieged the citadel. But after 4 days, those Turkish defenders did not come out. In fact, a large Turkish army came out to meet them and surrounded the city. And so the Crusaders were very hungry. They were discouraged. They began to doubt the wisdom of the enterprise until someone had a vision, or at least he claimed to have a vision. He said that the holy lance with which the side of Christ had been pierced was buried in Antioch. And so he was led by a seer, and they dug where this man told them to dig. And wouldn't you know it, they found a spear. Convinced that that was the Holy Lance, the Crusaders, they were once more renewed in their resolution to continue their enterprise. The standard became the Holy Lance, and they were possessed of such frenzied zeal that when they came out to meet the larger Turkish army outside of the city of Antioch, the Turks broke ranks and ran. The Crusaders helped themselves to all the provisions that the Turks had brought with them. And after Antioch, they began their march toward Jerusalem. And finally, the armies caught their first glimpse of the holy city, June 7th of 1099. Now, those who were defending Jerusalem, they weren't Turks. They were Fatimite Arabs from Egypt. They were named after Fatima, which was Muhammad's daughter. They claimed descent from her. And it would seem that the Crusaders were met with such success because the Muslims were all discombobulated. They were divided. They were not unified. And although the Crusaders did expect a long siege, in early July they received news that a large Arab army was approaching. They came to the conclusion that they had to take the city or else withdraw. And so they begged God for support. They marched around the city barefoot. They were singing penitential hymns. And a few days after that, they attacked the walls, and resistance was strong. But finally, a single knight was able to climb to the top of the wall. And there he held a space where others would follow him. And as the breach grew, the resistance melted. The defenders fled from the walls. The Crusaders swept into the city. That was the goal of their long campaign. And on July 15th of 1099, the Crusaders took back Jerusalem. And I wish I could tell you that it was a bloodless affair, but it was far from that. You know, Augustine had laid down the principles for a just war centuries before any of this took place. It was to be conducted by the state. Its purpose was for the vindication of justice, meaning the defense of life and property. And its code called for a respect for non-combatants, hostages, prisoners. But all of these evaporated in the heat of the holy cause. That's how Bruce Shelley writes about it. Gonzalez details how gruesome the bloodbath was. All the defenders were killed, as well as many civilians. Women were raped, infants thrown against walls. Many of the city's Jews had taken refuge in the synagogue, and the Crusaders set fire to the building with them inside. According to an eyewitness, at the Porch of Solomon, horses waded in blood. And as Shelley writes, for seven centuries, Christians have tried to forget the Crusades, but neither Jew nor Muslim will allow them to do so. In our liberated generation, it is easy to dismiss the whole bloody affair as insane religious bigotry, forgetting the context in which it occurred. Again, this was a reaction to what the Muslims had did centuries before under the Caliph, the successors of Muhammad, living out his principles, the things that he had instructed his followers to do in the Quran. Now, there's a lot more to this story, but time is running short, and so we'll have to pick this up in another episode. But granted, there was a lot of atrocities that took place during the Crusades, but history is not so simplistic as our fearless leader, Pastor Obama, would have us to believe. There's a lot more at work here than just people committing terrible deeds in the name of Christ. Yes, they took up the sign of the cross, but I didn't even get to the part where Saladin from Egypt, one of the Muslim leaders, declares jihad during the Crusade. Now, we'll have to come back to that, but it would seem that, as Thomas Madden, the historian from the University of St. Louis, has rightly noted, the president doesn't know much about the Crusade. Doesn't seem to know much about history, period. That's not really fair. What happens a lot of the times is history gets rewritten. That's why I didn't just try to retell it myself. I actually went to some very good sources. Justo Gonzalez is not a lightweight, okay? This guy, he got a master's degree from Yale. He was the youngest person to be awarded a PhD in historical theology at Yale. This is no slouch. Dr. Gonzalez is a prime source when it comes to history. Bruce Shelley, whose book Church History in Plain Language that I've cited in this episode as well, he's senior professor of church history and historical theology at Denver Theological Seminary. These guys are accredited. They know whereof they speak. And so as I've noted from these guys' writings, to make the claim, as fearless leader Pastor Obama has made, that these people were doing this in the name of Christ, I think, again, it's simplistic. The motives were varied. I'm sure there was some religious zeal. As Shelley, as I mentioned from Shelley and what he wrote, Bruce Shelley in his book, what he writes, it's easy to dismiss the whole bloody affair as insane religious bigotry. But there's a larger context going on here. With initially the Muslims being the aggressors, they're the ones who took Jerusalem in, what was it, 638? And for centuries, the Christians patiently made their pilgrimages to the Muslim-occupied lands. And it was only when reports started coming that the Christians were being persecuted by the Seljuk Turks that the call went up from what would seem to be a rather impetuous and power-hungry Pope, Pope Urban II, that some things began to set in motion. Yes, I'm sure there was some desire for them to take back the Holy Lands and to once again occupy those things, the spiritual rewards that Urban had promised. That's not biblical. I'm sure there was a profound reverence for the soil where Christ had trod, but this was a new type of war that the church had not known before this. And it did incite some bad things, but again, there's a larger context going on here than just, oh, well, you know, we shouldn't get on our high horse because these... It's a simplistic view of history. I don't applaud it. It's kind of disturbing. We could argue for some kind of hidden agenda, but given the way the president has conducted himself in these the years of his presidency, the years of his terms in office, he's constantly the last one to know about stuff. Well, I just heard about this on the news. I heard about it when you heard about it. You know, there's been news reels of that when he said these kinds of things. So he seems, unfortunately, terribly misinformed. His speech writers seem to be misguided. And so I'm going to continue this in another episode concerning the Crusades, because it's such a rich history to try and compress it into a single sentence as our president has done, does it a very severe injustice. I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. I always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit. Like the Facebook page. You'll get all the updates when I go live the podcast. Update the blog or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. Question of the Day segments are there for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Follow me on Twitter, @InPulpit, at the letter N as in Nick, Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Be sure and stop by the Life from the Pulpit blog, L-I-F-E, from the pulpit.wordpress.com. I'll have a commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, now Philippians, all there, all available, all free for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, Life from the Pulpit. Download all the episodes to your particular iDevice. You'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Be sure and check out Merced Church of Christ website, mercedchurchofchrist.org, mercedchurchofchrist.org. Plenty of sermon audio there to help you grow in your daily walk. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.